This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, Anthony Albanese backs his finance minister as text messages emerge, suggesting she knew about the Bruce Lehrman, Brittany Higgins matter before it became public. Also, what's to blame for inflation, corporate profits or pay rises? The answer's complex, but struggling workers say don't look at us.
It's not our fault. If I got a wage increase, it wouldn't like increase my savings. It'd just go into other things that are necessities.
Don't think wage increases are the issue. I think it's, you know, the cost of living. We're all getting hit hard.
And could the destruction of a dam in southern Ukraine cause a worldwide food shortage? Thanks for your company. The Prime Minister is standing by his Finance Minister amid questions over whether she had prior knowledge about the Brittany Higgins, Bruce Lehrman matter before the story broke in the media. In a parliamentary hearing 2 years ago, Katie Gallagher strongly denied any knowledge of the matter, but a slew of text messages reportedly sent between Ms. Higgins and her partner and released in the media today have called that denial into question. Andrew Probyn is the ABC's political editor. Andrew, what do these reported text messages tell us about Katie Gallagher's potential knowledge of this affair, and why does that matter?
Well, it matters, David, because she said previously that she had no prior knowledge, but we'll get to that in a moment because text exchanges leaked to the Australian newspaper assert that Katie Gallagher knew of the rape allegation before Brittany Higgins' interview with The Project. Now, the text exchange dates from February 11, 2021, which is 4 days before Brittany Higgins' interview with Lisa Wilkinson was aired on February 15. And these text messages are between Brittany Higgins and her partner, David Shiraz, who says at one point, "Katie Gallagher messaged me. She's angry and wants to help." Brittany Higgins says, "Can I see her message?" David Shiraz responds, "Yep, I gave her the Project interview for context. I hope that's okay." And Brittany Higgins replies, "Well, that's fine. It'll all be public pretty soon anyway." The significance is that back in June 2021, so some months later, Linda Reynolds, who was the employer of Brittany Higgins and who had the office, which was allegedly where the rape was, said that she'd been tipped off by a Labor senator that the Labor Party planned to weaponize the alleged rape and that this was 2 weeks before the Project interview with Brittany Higgins. Let's hear that exchange from June 2021.
"I was told by one of your senators 2 weeks before about what you were intending to do with the story in my office, 2 weeks before."
"I had no knowledge of this."
"No one had any knowledge."
"Okay.
I had no knowledge of this."
"How dare you?"
"Order. Now we will move."
"It's all about protecting yourself."
"We may suspend if we're going to continue down this path."
So, Andrew, we heard that exchange there between Linda Reynolds, Penny Wong and Katie Gallagher at the end there. She said, "No one had any knowledge. How dare you? It's all about protecting yourself." Now, considering what we know now or think we know with these text messages, is that enough to constitute an accusation of misleading Parliament?
Well, here's the question, David. Could Katie Gallagher be suggesting she didn't know 2 weeks before, that her foreknowledge was shorter, a matter of days? But the way that Katie Gallagher is so indignant in saying that no one had knowledge, that's a distinction that wouldn't carry much weight, I wouldn't think. In any case, the Prime Minister was asked today if he had full confidence in Katie Gallagher.
"I have absolute confidence in Senator Gallagher. I don't take advice from anyone. I had not met Brittany Higgins until I met her publicly on the same day that she met Scott Morris."
Anthony Albanese there, but that answer has not satisfied the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, who is supporting Linda Reynolds' determination to refer this matter to the National Anti-Corruption Commission, which opens for business on July 1.
"I think that's why the Integrity Commission will have an interest in looking at the sequence of events, because if if there is a question about the process involved in a payout, or there is a question around the Prime Minister's own words in relation to this, or presentations that have been made, or statements that have been put on Hansard, then they're very serious allegations.
That's the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, there. Andrew, we heard him make reference to a payout there. What's that about?
Well, last December, Brittany Higgins received a compensation payment from the Commonwealth, reportedly between $2 and $3 million. That wasn't long after the ACT, Director of Public Prosecutions, announced there wouldn't be a retrial of Bruce Lehrman, who vehemently denies assaulting Brittany Higgins. Now, Linda Reynolds, she questions why that payment was made so swiftly after that decision by the DPP and why she wasn't allowed to attend the mediation. Mark Dreyfus was speaking today and he says this payment followed all due process.
I made the decision here as Attorney General to settle this claim that was brought against the Commonwealth. It was made, a decision that I made, absolutely in accordance with the Legal Services direction. And the finance minister had no part to play. And again, that's standard. The attorney general is in charge of litigation against the Commonwealth and has to approve settlements.
Mark Dreyfus there. But look, with Parliament returning next week, David, you can expect there'll be a lot more questions about who knew what before the project went to air.
Andrew Probyn there, speaking to us from our Parliament House Bureau in Canberra. As the Reserve Bank continues to ratchet up the pressure on borrowers in an attempt to bring down inflation, fingers are being pointed as to why that task is proving so hard. Many economists believe recent wage rises are playing into the RBA's thinking on persistently high inflation. But now one of the world's influential economic think tanks says corporate profits have contributed far more to recent inflationary rises than wage increases. So who's right? Nell Whitehead has this report.
So who or what is to blame for inflation? For these workers in Sydney, it's definitely not their pay rises.
Well, it's not our fault. If I got a wage increase, it wouldn't increase my savings. It'd just go into other things that are necessities in life.
Look, I can definitely say with my mortgage, with the cost of living, groceries, everything, it hasn't even made a dent. I can't even really tell that I've had a pay increase, to tell you the honest truth. It's just kind of nearly levelled me back out to where I was before everything started increasing. I don't think wage increases are the issue. I think it's the fact that, the cost of living and everything like that is where we're all getting hit hard.
Ever since prices started rising, there have been concerns that higher wages would drive up inflation further. And the RBA still has its eye on salaries. It hiked interest rates to 4.1% on Tuesday after the Fair Work Commission decided to raise minimum award wages by almost 6%. The Reserve Bank's boss, Philip Lowe, is worried about a spiral.
We're in a difficult position where the society, understandably, wants to protect the lowest paid workers, but we've got to make sure that the higher inflation doesn't translate into higher wage outcomes for everybody, because if that happens, the inflation persists.
Others say the problem isn't wage increases and that Australia's recent inflation is being driven by corporate profits. A new report from the OECD says company earnings did more to push up prices in Australia last year than rising labour costs. Jim Stanford is director of the Centre for Future Work at the Australia Institute.
Researchers around the world have been trying to examine the inflation we've experienced since the COVID pandemic, because it's quite different than other inflationary episodes that we've had in history. So the OECD report is another installment in this growing international body of research. And like previous reports, it shows very clearly that in many countries, including Australia, profits have been far and away the biggest single factor driving higher prices. There's no doubt at all that corporations have been winners from this inflation, and wages have not kept up with prices.
He argues that Australian businesses have increased prices way above their costs. His research for the left-leaning think tank claims that excess corporate profits account for 69% of inflation, beyond the RBA's target of 2-3%.
And our findings were not really that surprising when you think about how much we've been paying for petrol and gas and groceries and airfares. I think most Australians have a gut-level understanding that some people in Australia are doing very well because of inflation.
This same debate is playing out across the world. This week, the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, said it seemed that corporate profits were, in some cases, worsening the EU's inflation. That's fed calls to stop or even overturn interest rate hikes. But the idea that corporate fat cats are the problem is disputed by a lot of economists who say it relies on flawed and misleading methodology.
I don't frankly think it's credible for a couple of reasons.
Stephen Hamilton is an associate professor of economics at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
Just based on the data, it isn't the case that profits of companies outside of the mining industry have risen in excess of inflation. Certainly mining companies are, you know, benefiting massively from very high commodity prices and are generating very high profits, and that's kind of part of the story. But in terms of what we pay in the basket, you know, the goods and services we buy domestically, the share of profit in the prices of those goods and services simply haven't risen dramatically in the past couple of years.
The Treasury and Reserve Bank have also dismissed the Australia Institute's corporate profits analysis. Steve Hamilton says, in the end, there's only one way to bring down inflation. And unfortunately, it has to be painful.
The only way the inflationary situation can be dealt with is by reducing aggregate demand. And there's no painless way to do that, right? So it's sort of the RBA is doing it one way. You know, you could come up with another way to do it, but ultimately people need less money because we need them to spend less. And it's hard for people to hear that, right? It's hard to understand, but that's kind of, unfortunately, there's no kind of easy way out.
That's Associate Professor Stephen Hamilton from the George Washington University. Nell Whitehead, our reporter there. Well, today a new nationwide ban was proposed on certain Nazi hate symbols, prompting some to ask what the laws would actually achieve. The federal government wants to ban flags, armbands, T-shirts, insignia, and the publication of symbols online promoting Nazi ideology. But some experts believe these laws could end up providing right-wing extremists with the attention they're looking for. Fatima Alumi reports.
Vic Oladef is no stranger to anti-Semitic hatred and abuse.
On too many occasions, I was confronted by swastikas threatening messages in my inbox with references to Nazis, references to Hitler, that the Jews should have all been wiped out, etc., that Hitler didn't finish the job.
Vic Oladef is the former chief of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies, and he's dedicated his life to stopping anti-Semitism. When he's confronted by it, it impacts him on a personal level, especially given both his grandparents were killed during the Holocaust. He says despite it being almost 80 years since the Holocaust ended, Nazism hasn't waned, and he still gets called to mediate anti-Semitic conflict in schools.
Three senior students at a major school posted on Twitter, "It's time to burn the Jews, it's time to gas the Jews." In another recent incident, at a large school in Sydney, a student in a year 10 chemistry lab blasted a stream of gas at a Jewish student, a young girl, and said to her, you know, see how the Holocaust felt.
Neo-Nazi groups have been increasingly visible lately. Recently, they attended an anti-immigration rally in Melbourne, where they clashed with other protesters. At another rally in March, neo-Nazis turned up and performed the Nazi salute. These public displays have prompted the federal government to introduce new laws to ban certain Nazi symbols. If passed, they'll ban symbols related to Nazis or the SS, including on flags, armbands, T-shirts in public and online. Mark Dreyfus is the Federal Attorney General.
We're indicating the seriousness with which we take this by imposing a penalty of up to 12 months imprisonment.
The proposed changes won't apply to swastikas because of its significance to South Asian religions for centuries. But not everyone believes these laws will have the desired effect. Dr. Bill Swanee is a lecturer at the Australian Catholic University Law School.
Well, it's quite likely that the law will actually be counterproductive and that will actually produce prosecutions which allow a public platform for Nazis to promote their views, and that would cause further harm.
What the federal laws won't do is ban the Nazi salute. The Commonwealth says that's a job for the states and territories to deal with. Victoria has already done this. Tasmania is also in the process of considering a ban. Bill Swanee says banning a gesture can be difficult.
It could prompt a counter-response. Obviously, the Nazi salute is easy to confuse with lots of very daily gestures like hailing a taxi. So there is real problems around banning a gesture which, although has a very offensive meaning, it also has lots of ordinary meanings.
Not everyone is sceptical about the possible impact of the proposed laws. Professor Catherine Gelber is a hate speech expert at the University of Queensland.
You can't avoid drawing a line in the sand on things that are unacceptable. In case people who are then prosecuted under those provisions then use that as a platform to get more publicity.
Professor Gelber wants more action outside of legal methods, like stopping the spread of right-wing ideologies on social media.
One of the really important things that needs to be done here is work with the platforms, because the platforms themselves, their entire business model is based on clicks.
Federal Attorney General Mark Dreyfus says the new laws are only the beginning of the government's plans to tackle right-wing extremism.
Fatima Alumi with that report. This is PM. I'm David Lipson. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. High-level international negotiations are continuing between Australia, Ukraine and the United States over the fate of our decommissioned fighter jets in what could become this country's largest ever single transfer of military equipment to a foreign power. But should Australia be giving its used second-hand FA-18 Hornets to Ukraine, and what difference might they make on the battlefield? Alison Shaw takes a look.
FA-18 Hornet jets were the RAAF's main weapon for decades, seeing action in the invasion of Iraq and the fight against Islamic State. But today, they're sitting in a hangar, mothballed. Now Ukraine is hoping they'll be able to use these retired jets in their own mission against Russia.
It's capable of both air-to-air and air-to-ground missions. And the two really important things that an F-18 would bring is a radar that has much longer range than the current Ukrainian MiGs do, and weapons that would have longer range.
Mick Ryan is a military strategist and retired Australian Army Major General.
The aim would to be not attack Russia, it would be to push Russian aircraft further away from the borders of Ukraine, so it makes it much more difficult for them to launch cruise missiles. So it would make a lot of sense for Australia to actually make this significant contribution.
It might be hard getting them there, though. Jen Parker is the Deputy Director of Defence at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
Australia does own them, but the US does own the IP. So you would need approval from both the Australian government and the US government for those to be sent to Ukraine.
Jen Parker says although Kyiv has assured the White House it won't deploy the Hornet jets into Russian airspace, there are still other hurdles to overcome on the Australian side.
I think there's a couple of challenges with the FA-18s. They were decommissioned in 2021 and they have been sitting in a shed at Rafflin Town since then. Fighter aircraft require significant maintenance, so it's not a case of just shutting it down for 2 years and starting it up. And there's also the thing about there's a big difference between providing Hawkeyes or Bushmasters to Ukraine, which are really capabilities that help protect troops. The F-18 is a defensive capability, but it is also an offensive capability. But I think it would be a significant step change for Australia if they did approve it. And I think it's a decision that would not be taken lightly.
It's widely believed Australia is about to announce a new package of support for Ukraine.
I do think that we will see some announcements from Australia between now and mid-July. I think it would be very difficult for the Australian Prime Minister to head to the NATO conference in Lithuania without a package of military support to Ukraine.
Many in the defence community believe Ukraine is the perfect destination for the 41 decommissioned jets. Michael Shoebridge is the founder and director of Strategic Analysis Australia.
It just seems that defence here and the government are on autopilot about the FA-18s. So in recent weeks I've seen celebration of delivering these fighter jets, not to Ukraine to help them fight their war, but to air museums in Australia. Providing military assistance to Ukraine now is it's deeply in our interests.
Members of the federal opposition have written a letter to the government urging them to do more to assist Ukraine, including Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Birmingham.
We also
need to see timely decisions and quick decisions and quick delivery of promises that are made. And the Albanese government isn't being transparent about when commitments are actually being delivered upon. They're taking a terribly long time to actually make decisions. And we're now in an embarrassing situation where the Ukrainian government is running a public campaign asking Australia to make decisions which shouldn't have to wait for Anthony Albanese to be able to have a media opportunity around the NATO Leaders Summit. They should be made now.
A spokesperson for the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, says it's disappointing the Coalition are playing politics with the issue and the government has briefed them to ensure bipartisan support.
Alison Shaw reporting there. Meanwhile, Kyiv's accusing Moscow of shooting at rescuers as evacuations continue across parts of southern Ukraine flooded by the destruction of the Novokakhovka Dam. Right now, authorities are scrambling to get fresh water to people trapped in the floods. And there are also worries thousands of landmines may have been dislodged. The broader impacts could be severe, some suggesting grain fields may turn into deserts and that global food supplies could be affected. Volodymyr Dubovik is an associate professor of international relations at the Odessa University in southern Ukraine.
The Kakhovka artificial sea, as they often call it, the reservoir, was actually built to provide more water for irrigation, amelioration in the south of Ukraine, because we have very fertile soil, but sometimes the water is lacking, and therefore we need that water. Now that water is gone, and now there is no source of that water for a large area in Ukraine. So it's going to be a problem. Right now, of course, we're dealing with immediate effects of a dam being exploded because you have a flood, you have people drowning, you save people, you save animals. There is a lot of, ecological damage because the water is bursting through, is polluted, and we've already seen some videos, some footage of the fish dying and so on. But eventually, the bigger problem would be just exactly as you said, for the agriculture of Ukraine.
The region, as you say, has a massive agricultural output. If so much of this land is destroyed, and if water to those regions is so badly affected, how big a blow is this to Ukraine's economy and perhaps significantly its ability to feed the rest of the world?
Well, I think in the short run it would be a serious blow, but then, of course, we'll probably come up with some solutions. Ukrainians are very creative. And also a lot of territory, vast territory in the south of Ukraine is very fertile. So the flooding that we're seeing now is not affecting all of that territory, but a substantial amount of it, but not all. So there'll be some opportunities, of course, for Ukraine to continue to grow, harvest and export it to the world. And so I don't think that this explosion would really aggravate dramatically the situation with world food supply. But that's another dent. And I hope that Ukraine would be able, maybe with some assistance from our partners and international organizations, would be able to deal with this somehow and offset some of the losses that we're facing here.
Some analysts have suggested that the counteroffensive, when it comes, may try to cut Russia off from the territory it occupies in Crimea. Yes. Will the destruction of this dam have any bearing on such a strategy?
Well, it has a bearing on the situation in Crimea because water has been coming to Crimea also from that area. So right now, Russians are having problems with supplying fresh water in Crimea. Most of the water is, all the water is coming from Crimea to from Ukraine. So that's always been a problem for Crimea. Russians haven't been able to actually solve that problem. In terms of cutting the so-called land bridge between Donbas region of Ukraine and Crimean region of Ukraine, that would be the prized trophy, really. That would be a big achievement if that happens, because then the Russian position in Crimea becomes untenable. If you add to it the bridge along the Kerch Strait, which was damaged by some explosions some time ago, it's in a very precarious situation as well. That bridge can be destroyed, and then Russia has no way of supplying flying population of Crimea and their troops in Crimea. So that's going to really put pressure really high on Russia in terms of continuing to defend Crimea. But Ukrainian troops are right now still far away from reaching that goal, cutting that land bridge. But that would be great if we come towards Melitopol and Mariupol and actually cut that land bridge. But Russians are aware that that would be a big achievement for Ukrainian troops, so they're probably concentrating most of their defenses in that area. So Ukrainian troops might be more creative in trying to come up with more of interesting, unconventional areas of offensive.
That's Volodymyr Dubovik from Odessa University there. In the United States, the field of candidates for the Republican presidential nomination is still growing, with former VP Mike Pence formally announcing his bid. In a not-so-subtle reference to Donald Trump, he told supporters he'll put the Constitution before himself. His announcement comes as media speculation intensifies that the former president will soon be charged with offences relating to his handling of classified documents. But political pundits say, regardless, it's unlikely anyone can beat Donald Trump to the nomination. Samantha Donovan with this report.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 48th Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, and Mrs. Karen Pence.
Mike Pence announced his candidacy at a rally in Iowa, where the first votes for the Republican nomination will be cast next year.
Before God and my family, I'm announcing that I'm running for President of the United States of America.
And Mike Pence is no longer mincing his words about what happened when Trump supporters stormed the Capitol in 2021.
January 6th was a tragic day. As I've said many times, President Trump's words were reckless. They endangered my family and everyone at the Capitol. But the American people deserve to know that on that day, President Trump also demanded that I choose between him and the Constitution. Now voters will be faced with the same choice. I chose the Constitution, and I always will. I will always believe, by God's grace, I did my duty that day. I kept my oath to ensure the peaceful transfer of power under the Constitution of the United States of America.
The New York Times and other American media outlets are reporting Donald Trump's lawyers have been told by federal prosecutors the former president is a target of their investigation into the handling of classified documents, and speculation is growing that he'll soon be indicted on that matter. Earlier this year, Trump was indicted at the state level over an alleged hush money scheme during the 2016 election. David Smith is an associate professor at the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. He says Mike Pence is presenting himself to voters as the most traditional Republican in the field.
Really, as a pre-Trump Republican who follows what used to be the party line on everything from economics to foreign policy, so many of these things which Trump has really deviated from. At the moment, polling suggests that Pence doesn't really have much of a chance. He's polling at about 5% in Republican primary fields, which is better than some of the other contenders in there, but obviously a long way off Trump and even a long way off Ron DeSantis, who really is Trump's biggest competitor in the field. What's going to be very interesting is if Trump and Pence are sharing a debate stage together, Trump really regards Pence as a traitor because Pence wouldn't help him overturn the result of the 2020 election on January 6th. And Pence, I think, is going to try to use this in order to get some votes from Republicans who are really uncomfortable with what Trump did on January 6th and are uncomfortable with him continuing to claim that the election was stolen from him.
Do you think he'll have much success with that argument?
So in the anti-Trump field, it might help him to get a few points on his competitors. But really, unless something actually happens to Trump, unless criminal prosecutions somehow stop him from running or unless he has some significant health problem, it's very difficult to see Pence coming within any range of actually beating Trump. And I tend to think that some of the people who are in the Republican field at the moment are in there in the hope that something could actually happen to stop Trump from being in the primaries.
That's Dr. David Smith from the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. Samantha Donovan, our reporter there. And that's the program for today. Thanks for joining us on PM. I'm David Lipson. You can check out the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. Samantha Donovan will in fact be your host tomorrow. In the meantime, have a good evening. Good night.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. This week, Bruce Lehrman gave his first media interview after the trial over the alleged rape of Brittany Higgins was abandoned last year. It came as an inquiry into the justice system's handling of the case heard its final evidence. Today, we speak to ABC court reporter Elizabeth Byrne, who's covered the story from the start. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.